Hello, Jordan. How's it going?
What's up, Rob?
Well, you know, not much. I gotta say, I'm pretty disturbed right now. I've been seeing some really alarming footage coming out of China lately. The last day or so, I've seen some really awful, terrifying footage of student activists and professors, you know, being rounded up, attacked, assaulted, arrested by masked, jackbooted thugs, agents of the state, being dragged away. And you know, we might have a lot of problems in our society, you know, either in Canada, the United States, you know, we got our own problems, but I see that kind of stuff sometimes and just say, well, thank goodness we live in a culture where we have this commitment to these value, these ironclad values of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and we don't have to worry about any of this kind of horrifying authoritarianism. It just makes me thankful to... Wait, no, sorry, I'm just getting a note from our producer.
Oh,
and
uh-oh.
That is... Okay, that was happening in the United States of America today, Jesus, actually. Oh, no. So I was mistaken on that.
Sorry. But I think that under... Like, it's... When you think about it, just let's think through it. It's important that we do this. We should be doing this. And any response to student protests of violence should be proportionate. So, I think that's totally fine.
Good. I'm glad we're on the same page about that.
Did you see that that fire, that alleged free speech, Bill of Rights protecting organization that's kind of like a libertarian, almost right-leaning alternative to the ACLU? A tweet from somebody at that organization saying, like, it's important to remember that any response to protests be proportionate. It wasn't this is bad. It was, all right, there's a right amount of violent response by the state.
What
other circumstance would you make that argument?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, we talked about this a little bit on Tuesday on the bonus episode there. But yeah, seems like there's a few caveats when it comes to the whole commitment to free speech that some of these folks have. I mean, it's crazy the way that's being justified. You know, like I saw today, I believe it was on MSNBC, and I think it was like an NYU professor. And the way that like they're going on, people are just going on television and making this is NYU professor Scott Galloway on MSNBC when he was in the process of blaming China for these anti-Israel protests and claiming that it was China's fault because of TikTok. And, you know, not people just being exposed to horrifying images of violence and genocide and being against it. But this guy goes on TV and he just talks about like, you know, this is how this kind of liberal two-step works when it comes to freedom of speech and protest and assembly and stuff. When he says like, you know, of course we all have to be able to protest, but if there was like a Ku Klux Klan rally at one of these universities or anyone was calling for, you know, the murder of black people or anything like that, of course it would be shut down right away. But why the double standard? And the way this is like completely just totally taken for granted. And the guy doing the interview is just like, no, of course you're right. We have to talk about why this double standard exists, as if there's any fucking connection whatsoever between these campus protests for students that are against genocide and against some of the worst, most horrifying violence that we've seen in years and years. And they just treat this analogy like, oh, it's basically just like a Klan rally. And this is just totally taken for granted and not challenged in any way. It's just like, it's crazy to me. Like, it's crazy the way that this is just there. These descriptions are just used and employed and no one really bats an eye. People keep talking about these horrifying instances of anti-Semitism without providing any real examples of anything that's gone on at these rallies that can be classified like that. I don't know. It's just mind blowing the way this discourse has been allowed to progress like this.
There's a few issues with what he's talking about. So, oh, of course it would be shut down if it was a KKK rally. No, it wouldn't. It absolutely would not. There's a couple of different reasons, right? So,
in fact, this whole conservative apparatus would spring into action to ensure that, like, they would continue to have that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they would take the stance of, and they did. And honestly, this isn't to credit them. I'm just pointing out that these arguments were made. There were people like on the right. I think Matt Walsh of the Daily Wire is like, this should not be the response. Like the whole point of the First Amendment is that people with unpopular views also get to exercise their rights. Didn't see Ben Shapiro making that argument, but like there are some people who see this for what it is. Like this is a ridiculous overreach by police, by the state, by governments. He was specifically critical of Abbott because I think he sees Abbott as somebody who's good, quote, on the issue of campus free speech. And also the hypocrisy, the blatant hypocrisy there is ridiculous because he's prided himself on protecting campus free speech, signed a law a year or two ago, has made that part of his political identity. But there's Supreme Court precedent for groups like the KKK to demonstrate, to do whatever. And by no means is that the government or authority saying this is good and we endorse it. Although a lot of the same members of the police are also in groups like the KKK.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there. Look, even if you really want to pride yourself on having a free speech society and people absolutely being able to exercise their rights to assemble, if they're not actually causing harm in what they're doing, I would argue the KKK does cause harm even by assembling, even by associating. Their entire identity is one to cause harm. The Supreme Court didn't see it that way. Unsurprising, but this is back in like the 70s or 80s. I can't remember which case, but it was like literally a burning cross case. If they were just doing it in the field under the Supreme Court's interpretation, that's their right. If they're doing it in someone's front yard to intimidate them, that's different.
Yeah, and like when you bring up Matt Walsh and his kind of stance on this, and that's the thing that's kind of perplexing to me as well. Like you would think even supporters of Israel that don't have their heads just entirely up their own asses would recognize that all that's any of this is going to do is just completely galvanize these protests even more and encourage more protest and more encampments, more activism. Like there's now campuses across the country that have this kind of activity happening and all of the, sending in the riot squad to bust these up and all the rhetoric about anti-Semitism and the condemnations, it's only just increasing that activity. And it's only hardening the hearts of everyone that's involved with it. So you'd think maybe some of these folks might be able to wrap their minds around this concept that you're actually, if you view this as being a serious problem, this kind of campus activism, you're only feeding into all these narratives and increasing this activism significantly by responding with this like heavy hand trying to bust up these protests and encampments with state violence. But I guess these folks just can't resist. They can't help it. They get so upset when, anyone just doesn't immediately pledge fealty to Israel that it just makes them very, very upset. And this is how they react. So I'm really kind of curious and interested to see how this is going to develop because it seems like there's been a kind of like tectonic shift here. The response to it, the heavy-handed response is only pouring gasoline on the fire. So it just seems like it's not something that's going to go away or lessen in intensity. So it's going to be interesting to keep our eyes on it. And we don't need to get into this too much. I know you spoke today with Jay Willis and you talked a bit about these protests. So we don't need to get fully into it now, but I wanted to mention some of this stuff up front here before we get to that.
Yeah. We talked about the campus protests. We obviously talked about gaming a bit. Jay, big gamer.
Good.
We talked about the Supreme Court hearing arguments in the case about Trump's legal team claiming he has absolute immunity for everything he did as president, which is on its face a ludicrous claim. We've talked about that a lot. Well, that case was actually today. So we talked about those arguments. But before we get there, I also want to do point out on the campus protests, we're seeing these arrests. We're seeing them assaulted by police officers. I put together a site compiling all of the verified, that I could tell to the best of my ability, bail funds, which is just student organizers. It's typically Venmos. So if that makes you uncomfortable, that's fine. But also these funds will help provide them resources. Maybe down the line they need legal representation or other supplies. If you go to campusbailfunds.com, of the ones that I've seen, I have a link to each one. links you to their Venmo or Cash App, on top of a link to the National Bail Fund Network if you would rather just donate there. It all helps. You know, students are typically not the wealthiest or most financially comfortable members of society, and that they're sticking their neck out on an issue like this peacefully and being met with state violence, it's a good thing to support. So campusbailfunds.com, we put that together today. Hopefully we can help these students who are risking life and limb to stand up for people in Gaza.
Yeah, no, it's really cool that you did that. I saw Andy Ngo like quote tweeted you or screenshotted you or something. Yeah. And hope that's okay. You know, I've had a lot of people say a lot of stuff about me over the years, but never have I gotten more fucked up targeted harassment than when I've crossed paths with Andy Ngo. So hopefully you don't have too many absolute lunatics in your mentions there. I know that's not fun.
I think he's losing his edge.
Yeah.
I didn't get like anything. I maybe got a couple like boomers being like, oh, is the money going to Hamas? Like, that's it.
Yes,
I swear. Yeah, every link is just a coded donation to Hamas. No, we're kidding. I maybe he's like lost his touch because I didn't get anything. I don't want to tempt fate. I also just don't care. I would just meet them and move on.
Yeah.
But nothing really happened.
Okay, well, you hate to see it. Even the heavyweights start losing their influence like that. Very unfortunate.
Well, also this week, you and I had a guestless episode where we talked more about the campus protests, the video, trigger warning, content yeah. warning. The video, we talked about the video of the woman getting brutally stabbed in the eye with a
deeply disturbing
pole,
yeah.
that real thing that happened.
Yeah. It was very scary stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good to go over that with you. I like doing those more intimate episodes, Jordan. I like that one. It's just you and me.
I like getting intimate with you as well. Yeah,
absolutely. And the listeners of the show seem to enjoy it as well. You know, so don't ask me what's motivating that, but you know, that's uh-huh. just, that's what I hear. That's what they tell me, but it was a really good one. Please subscribe to the show if you want to hear that. And of course the other bonus content that we've put out over the years with some really fantastic guests. We do two episodes of the show every single week. So that's how you get both of them, is by subscribing over at insurgentspod.com. Mm-hmm.
Well, how about we get to our conversation with Jay Willis?
Let's get into it.
Jay will be joining us right after this. Joining me now is Jay Willis, editor-in-chief of Balls and Strikes. Jay, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well under the circumstances. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. So we ask all of our guests the same opening question, just so we know who we're dealing with, get a better understanding of them as a person. Jay, are you a gamer?
Oh boy. How long do we have? Like 4 hours? I hope 4 hours.
We can go long. Yeah.
I would say that most gamers would probably not define me as a gamer. I, however, would consider myself a gamer because I do love a good game. I think the challenge for me is that, the games that are nearest and dearest to my heart are sort of the ones that were around in my formative years, such that at my bachelor party a couple of years ago, one of my friends from college did me the most wonderful kindness, I think, that I could imagine, which is he dug up a like original Bush era Xbox and also managed to come up with a copy of the original Halo. So controllers that still actually function. A little NCAA 07 for the college football heads out there. Currently, I am riding a 23-season national championship streak with the mighty Cal Golden Bears. mostly, like, I don't know. I were like working in this field, in this industry, you just sort of expose yourself to, like unless you do something about it, pretty much just like a geyser of nonstop shit, right? And I think something I like about being able to play video games is that, I don't know, like I have to look at the screen and I have to hold something in my hand that's not a phone. And it just lets me do something other than think about my job or more generally the horrors of the world in which we all live.
It's a great answer. I am so excited. I'm curious how you feel, but I'm so excited for the return of college football video games.
I think it's going to be rad. Like it is.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, first of all, again, anyone can and should hit me up on Twitter if you want to play NCAA 07 in like the greater Seattle area. Like we can get together and I will put up 100 on you. But yeah, like everybody loves that, right? Like it's a classic series of games. Who doesn't like pretending to still be in college? And I think it's cool that they finally got the legal shit worked out enough so that I can pretend to be Jaden Daniels again. I think that's terrific.
I'm really excited. That was growing up. Those were my two summer purchases that I always made. It was college football and Madden.
Absolutely.
And I haven't been as much into Madden over the past few years because they got way too into the Ultimate Team microtransaction stuff and like the packs and building. I just want to play with the current rosters. I'm fine with that. College, this is also, just the absence is brutal. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
No, this is also one of my big objections to like some of the more modern games is like, you know what? On my dumbass Xbox, it doesn't connect to the, I don't have a dial-up connection anymore. Doesn't connect to the internet. You can't take a couple dollars from my credit card. You know, every time I want to make another trade or whatever. I appreciate that it is a closed universe again in which I am free to win as many Pac-10 championships as I please. The kids out there, they don't know what the Pac-10 is. That's another episode. That's premium content.
Yeah. I was just looking, I now have two Big Ten schools near me here in Los Angeles with USC and UCLA. And I was looking at the schedules and unfortunately it doesn't seem like Ohio State is headed out here in the next few years. So hopefully I can catch them at one of the LA school stadiums, but the decimation of that conference is really sad.
The Pac-12.
Yeah. Yeah. Just if you wanted to watch a college game late on a Saturday where a couple of teams with pretty poor defenses just air it out and throw for like 500 yards each, like that was your conference. It was great.
The brand is so strong with that. And also, I mean, I don't know. Like, I went to Cal. I live in Seattle now, and it was pretty cool to, you know, have regular opportunities to see my team, and more specifically, to see my team get the shit beat out of it by the Huskies. But like, yeah, it sucks that we're losing that, and like next year, I legitimately have to figure out where Wake Forest is. Like, it's in one of the Carolinas. I think it's in the north one. But like beyond that, you couldn't tell me anything about it.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of traditions that are gone. That sucks.
Yeah. It's rough. Well, you're here, Jay, to talk about the Trump immunity case in the Supreme Court, which is something I've been concerned about for a while. Very curious to hear your take and your analysis. But before we get there, we wanted to do a quick update on these campus protests. Encampments have popped up at many other schools around the country, and in some cases, especially at schools like Emory and Emerson, Texas, and Ohio State, among others, we've seen pretty swift police responses on top of the ongoing saga at Columbia University. I mean, Jay, as somebody who thinks about the law, writes about the law, thinks about the consequences for government actions in situations like this, I mean, what is your read on the state of, quote, campus free speech? This is something that I've been hearing a lot about, is something that we must protect at all costs. Does it seem like those arguments and the people making them are showing up in this moment where campus free speech is under attack?
It's been really disheartening to watch for, I mean, certainly the last 6 months, right? But even more specifically in these campus protests that you referenced the last few days, of just my social media timelines being unending scrolls of videos of militarized police marching on peaceful protesters, like, you know, beating them again. I saw there were rubber bullets flying, it looks like, at Emory today. It just feels like the same sort of despairing energy of 2020 all over again. People marching for a different cause, for a different marginalized community, and the same result of just the state meeting them with massive violent resistance when it's a message that that people in power don't favor. I'm also just like, at the same time, it does sort of, I do find it like heartening, right, that the kids have this right, you know, that that so quickly so many students at campuses across the country are mobilizing in support of Palestine, of the Palestinian people. And I don't know, like these movements never go correctly for the history, never looks kindly on the people in power who react to peaceful civil rights protests like this. And I am inspired by the courage that they show, and also sad that it's still something that they have to do.
Right. I think the media has done a poor job describing what these students sought out to do and were doing. What you've seen is obviously a lot of images and videos of state violence responding to what were just effectively sit-ins. They pitched tents on college campuses. Some of them had supplies, so they would just camp out there. Purely peaceful demonstrations. What we then started to see in between when these started to pop up and the police response were people unaffiliated with these protests. For instance, in the case of Columbia, it's not very hard to walk a block in any direction and see a crazy person. And there was a moment yesterday where a reporter for Punch Bowl News, and he was formerly at Axios or Politico, was six blocks away from campus, saw an open anti-Semite and said, "I'm here at the Columbia protest." No, you are six blocks away on a street corner. What's happening is on these college campuses by students, young people sitting in tents. And it's just it seems like a deliberate exercise in either misinformation or lies by omission from members of the media who are looking for a sensationalized story, and peaceful college students sitting in tents isn't enough for them. So it needs to be framed as, oh, these are anti-Semitic, or they're calling for violence. From what I've seen, maybe I'm wrong, that is not the case. It's just basically sit-ins. Is that right?
Yeah, and I've also been heartened a little bit to see, marveled really, at how good these students are at sort of clocking somebody as a provocateur and just ignoring them, giving them all of the attention that they deserve. There will always be people, you know, moths to a flame, who see an event like this and try to exploit it for their own ends, whether, you know, big picture pernicious or whether, you know, people who just want attention, like they will go to a place where there is attention. And I am inspired at how students at these protests have remained on message and just sort of ignored these attempts to gin up conflict, gin up violence, gin up unrest, where, as you say, there just really isn't any.
Yeah. And it's being framed as riots or violent protests, which again is not true. And I think it's important to point out that these would still just be kids sitting in tents on campuses if not for a militarized police showing up. I don't know if you saw, but on the campus of Ohio State, they had snipers on the roof. For what? Like, what do you need that for if not to ratchet up tensions, escalate things, create a situation that could escalate into violence? Like, that is horrifying. That type of response, I think, shows how disproportionate the willingness and the proclivity for force is from both of these sides, between the police and the students. The students are just sitting there. Cops are showing up with sniper rifles. Like, there's a total imbalance there.
Yeah, I was very moved by a picture that I saw making the rounds of police lining up at the campus of UT Austin, where they are next to, you know, one of these sort of aspirational platitude ad copy signs that every university has. What starts here changes the world. Next to, again, a row of a dozen cops and riot gear. I just sort of look at that and I think, like, you're right, but not the way you think, you know?
You're right. I did see that. That was just a perfect juxtaposition.
Yep.
Let's hope the sign is right. Jay, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Supreme Court case today. So Trump and his lawyers were before the justices arguing, this is their last attempt, for total immunity for president, specifically him. Now, you tuned in, you listened to the arguments, is that right?
Yeah, I hate garbage.
Look, I like that whole element, just following cases, listening to a recording of the arguments. In college I've talked about this maybe once or twice in the show. In college, my friends and I drove to the Supreme Court from Ohio and camped outside for a few days just to watch a case. It's just like something that I've always been fascinated by. So I don't know if I would classify listening as garbage, but maybe the case itself and the people hearing it. Maybe that's the garbage.
Yeah, I also blew the joke. I meant to say I love garbage. I trust that, you know, followers of my work will understand just how mm-hmm. much I will just swim through news that makes me want to hate myself.
Sure.
But yeah, I did listen to the case today, to the oral argument today. It was frankly worse than I expected. I think that there is sort of an emerging consensus among people who watch the court, who have tracked this case, and sensibly, I think that for as far right, for as extreme as this Supreme Court is, that they were not going to hand down a decision that says winning a presidential election means you can do as many crimes as you want. Like, I don't think there are five votes for what Donald Trump is asking for, which is, again, absolute immunity for criminal liability of anything he did in office, unless he is first impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate for it, which obviously in a body as polarized as the Senate is probably never going to happen, no matter what the president does. But the way the court has been handling this case kind of gives away the game, because the court doesn't actually have to hand down an opinion that a substantive opinion, right, that gives Trump the result he wants. As long as they hold on to the case, as long as they take longer to consider interlocutory appeal after interlocutory appeal to prevent this case from going to trial before November, that's as good as the absolute immunity for Trump. One way I've been thinking about this is, like, I don't even know if, like, Trump wants to be president in this. I mean, certainly not in the sense of, like, a serious commitment to public service, right? But, like, I don't know if he wants to do that work again so much as he wants attention, doesn't know what else to do, and really, really doesn't want to go to prison. And being president, I think, is the surest way for him to stay out of prison. And that's what so frustrates me about the court's handling of this. I think after oral argument that, you know, however the vote on the substantive question of absolute immunity comes down, I think that there are enough votes to remand this to the lower court for further proceedings about, you know, which of his acts as president were official within the scope of his job duties and which ones were not, such that he could be prosecuted for them. And again, I don't know what the answer will be, but again, there doesn't have to be an answer. This is just a game of running out the clock, and Trump's Republican allies on the Supreme Court are helping him do that.
So what are some of the arguments that his team made? I saw many hypotheticals thrown out by the justices, from assassinating an opponent to ordering a military coup. What could you talk about some of these lines of questioning, how Trump's legal team responded, but also, I guess, you say there's not five. Are there maybe three? Are there maybe four? Like, I guess, what is your read based on the questioning? Because it's kind of reading the tea leaves in these situations until we see the opinion. Do you think there's anybody who's on board? Is it Alito, maybe?
I mean, I think Alito would be the likeliest candidate, as well as Thomas. Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch tend to vote as a trio often in cases like this that are, you know, essential to the Republican Party's electoral chances. But consistent with sort of this idea that the best outcome for Donald Trump and the least damaging outcome to the Supreme Court's public image is further delaying the trial, I think a lot of the questions were less about, you know, the specific legal issues and more just like parsing through these hypotheticals that are designed to make this particular case much more complicated than it really is. And obviously, Supreme Court justices are, I mean, it's part of the Supreme Court's job, right, to think about the implications of their rulings for future cases. But, like, just to take an example, there was one exchange where Neil Gorsuch asked a hypothetical. He said, let's say a president leads a mostly peaceful protest sit-in in front of Congress because he objects to a piece of legislation that's going through. Is that a core function of his presidential duties and therefore immunized? Or is it not core and therefore prosecutable? Now, like, students of history will recognize that the series of events that led to January 6th were neither peaceful nor a protest. And resolution of this edge case about a make-believe president doing a make-believe civil rights protest is probably not necessary to determine that an actual president, Donald Trump's actual efforts to overturn an actual election, is not a core function of his duties as a chief executive. But, like, that's the sort of business that the Supreme Court was engaged in today. Justices Alito and Kavanaugh spent a lot of time, you know, sort of wondering about the possibility of, you know, bad faith prosecutions of ex-presidents if the court isn't careful enough with its ruling. And I'm writing an article about this for Balls and Strikes. Again, great website, ballsandstrikes.org. Everybody should read it. But there were a couple places where the lawyer for the government, Michael Grieben, sort of started to bring up the actual facts of the case. And I thought it was notable how quickly the Republican justices jumped in to cut him off. For example, Grieben made one allusion to Trump's demand, right, that Georgia election officials fined him 11,000 votes. And Gorsuch just hopped in and said, you know, look, I'm just focused on the legal test. Kavanaugh talked about, you know, I'm quoting here, I'm not focused on the here and now of this case. I'm very concerned about the future. And again, this sort of makes sense, right? Like, on the one hand, the justices do have to think about the future. But on the other hand, as long as they, you know, spend their time hemming and hawing about this specific case, the better the chances their preferred presidential candidate has come November.
The question from Sotomayor about if a president says a rival is corrupt and orders their assassination, is that within his official acts for which he can get immunity? And Sauer said it would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that that could well be an official act. Were there any limits to what Trump's legal team said a president could or couldn't do? Or is this there? Are they just saying literally anything he does is legal and or he's immune from? But is the and does those argument do those arguments? Sorry, do those arguments hinge on the idea that if the president does it, it's legal because the president did it? That line of thinking.
Yeah, it's very much reminiscent of the Nixon quote, right? It's honestly hard for me to really sort of look at Sauer's argument and say, like, yes, there was a clear strategy here. There was one, you know, when he was answering some of the hypotheticals posed by Justice Sotomayor and later by Justice Kagan, like, I thought I heard genuine surprise in Kagan's voice when she asked about, what was it? She asked about his efforts to persuade the convening of, let me start that over. She asked about Trump's election fraud lawsuits and the convening of slates of fake electors. And she asked whether that counted as an official or an unofficial act of a president. And she asked it in a way that like made clear that she expected Trump's lawyer to be like, well, obviously that's an unofficial act. And she seemed genuinely surprised that Sauer was really going for it, right? And saying, no, this was part of the president's duty. But there was also a very sort of notable exchange with Justice Amy Coney Barrett later, when she actually brought up some of the specific allegations in the indictment. Again, it was one of the rare moments when the justices and the lawyers actually talked about the facts instead of sort of legal constitutional theory. And Sauer seemed to allow that some of the allegations in the indictment might have been private, and thus that a trial could go forward at least on those allegations after all. But like, again, I don't know that he needed to have a super coherent theory of the case so much as he needed the oral argument to end with a lot of different justices thinking about a lot of different things that they are going to take a long time to write separate opinions about. At the end of oral argument, typically, right, the Chief Justice turns to the petitioner's lawyer, so in this case, Trump's lawyer, and gives them a couple minutes for rebuttal. You know, they went first, then it was the respondent. So just a chance to respond to anything relevant before the court, before he bangs the gavel. And, you know, he said, Mr. Sauer, rebuttal. And Trump's lawyers said, Chief Justice, Mr. Chief Justice, I have nothing further. Just pass. No, thank you. Like, what else is there to say, right? He didn't need to say anything else because he had done his job of buying the candidate more time. That's all we're talking about here.
So with these types of cases, I mean, it could come out whenever, but with these types of cases, typically the most significant ones, which are often the most highly anticipated ones, they wait until the last few days of the term. So we could be seeing these in June, late June. That then creates a few more months of delay, like you're saying, for anything to proceed regarding his criminal cases, criminal trials over his involvement in January 6th. I mean, is there a scenario where that process gets expedited, or is Trump's team then just going to bog down that case with more filings, more motions, just delay it and slow it down until after the election?
I think the timeline in the Colorado ballot case is really instructive. Again, that's the other Supreme Court case about the Republican nominee's involvement in January 6th. I know there's a lot of them floating around. I will, I always do my best to try and keep them straight. That's the case in which Colorado attempted to exclude Trump from its Republican primary ballot on the grounds that he is an oath-breaking insurrectionist. And the Supreme Court said, no, Colorado can't exclude Trump on that basis. So Trump's appeal of the Colorado Supreme Court decision was over the holidays. The Supreme Court granted cert in early January. It heard oral argument in early February and decided the case in early March, right before Super Tuesday. And clearly the court had that date in mind as a date when, you know, practically speaking, it needed to decide whether or not Trump could be on the ballot. So again, I'm talking about the timeline here. That's a month between oral argument and the decision. What I'm saying here is that when the court moving quickly is good for Donald Trump, the court knows how to move quickly. Like, the question here is whether when moving quickly is bad for Donald Trump, the conservatives will view the task before them as similarly urgent. I don't know, man. I almost don't want to speculate because I don't want to be optimistic and wrong, which is usually how I would guess the wrong way. I don't think they would leave this until the very end of the term. I think someone like John Roberts in particular understands just how bad this looks for a court that, you know, its polling numbers are already in the toilet. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly surprised me by just how shitty it is willing to be, especially when the political stakes are highest. So I am hopeful that, you know, there can be a trial before the election and that people can go to the polls with a better understanding of the facts, with a jury's determination of his innocence or guilt. But at this point, they're just running out of time.
I think I keep coming back to, I guess, to zoom out, is the ethical and moral and integrity issues around three of Trump's own appointees sitting in, like, presiding over this case. It's just, it's really glaring in moments like this. And of course, this isn't the first time that the role of the Supreme Court, the political and partisan elements in shaping it, the consequences on that front, and how it's influenced the outcomes of elections. That's not new, but it's certainly heightened now. And I guess, just how do you, or does anybody, continue to respect or have any faith whatsoever in its legitimacy as an institution? You see this and it's like, why should we give a shit? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, if you want an explanation as to why anyone respects the Supreme Court, that's not really a mindset I can occupy. I will say, like, some of this, I think, to your point about the absurdity of Trump's appointees presiding over a case that could determine his, you know, his electoral future, his ability to stay on the ballot in the case of the Colorado case. It's really sort of a classic lawyer brain problem where if a normal person who hasn't sunk $250,000 into law school, you know, notes how facially absurd this is, sort of the standard legal profession, legal culture responses, you know, well, Supreme Court justices, they swear an oath to uphold the law. They're not out there for, they're not out there as partisans. They're not out there to further their preferred party's goals to the extent that they even have a preferred party. The entire website of Balls and Strikes is premised on how stupid this is and rejects it entirely. But yeah, like the interest that a conservative justice has right now in the results of this case and the results of this election, I just don't see again how anyone who is not way too deep in the legal theory weeds clocks that as reasonable. So for example, like Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, they're young, relatively speaking, for Supreme Court justices. They're not going anywhere. But the reason that they are in the majority on these policy issues is because they have three colleagues who are a little bit older who make this six-justice conservative supermajority. It's not out of the question that whoever wins the White House in 2024 ends up replacing Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, or both. Just doing some quick math, right? Like if liberal justices replace those two, suddenly this six-justice conservative supermajority is a five-justice liberal majority. So like even if, you know, you countenance the idea that Brett Kavanaugh is able to, maybe he actually might be the worst example because he's just like a generic Republican in a gray suit who happens to have gone to law school. There's like 30,000 people, 30,000 dudes in the greater DC area that are just like Brett Kavanaugh. But like, yeah. even if you think about them as like, you know, deciding cases independently of the professional debt that they owe to Donald Trump, right? Like they're thinking about the future of the court too. They're thinking about remaining in the majority, and the best way for them to remain in a majority is to ensure that a Republican wins the White House next. I have been deeply dismayed at how the court has handled this. Not, to be clear, like I don't mean to suggest that I've been surprised at how they've handled it, right? Like especially someone like John Roberts understands just how much of a weapon procedure can be, slow walking a case can be, in terms of getting the real world outcomes that he wants. But it is one of those cases that lays bare how much power the court exercises, how much political power the court wields. When, you know, nine of ostensibly the smartest, fanciest lawyers in the country are sitting on the bench talking about the extent to which a president could face potential criminal consequences for like murdering a political opponent. Like this is the sort of thing that if you had like joked about it in 2016 as like, oh, you know, 8 years from now, what kinds of cases will the Supreme Court be considering? Like whether or not a president could legally order the assassination of his rival, that would have been right there in the dumb Twitter joke. But it's not. Like this is what we're actually dealing with. This is what the court's really doing. And the longer the court takes, the more the benefits accrue to Donald Trump.
Well, Jay, we'll keep an eye on how this goes whenever we get the opinion. And until then, we'll keep an eye on Balls and Strikes, where people can find you and your work. Where can people follow you elsewhere online?
Oh, let's see. I'm Jay Willis, J-A-Y Willis, on the artist formerly known as Twitter. You can find my writing at jaywillis.info. I'm still holding out hope for jwillis.com. To the best of my knowledge, Jay Willis, like, you know, when you're a kid and you think like, I'm going to type my name into .com and see what happens. Like, shout out to the Southern California based artist who has sat on jwillis.com since the first time I tried to do that. So what, probably 30 years ago, he is still going strong. I'm looking at it now, large scale sculpture, drawings, project models, beautiful stuff. Maybe someday I will have the handle. Until then, jwillis.info it will have to be.
And if you're looking for a new piece of art, you can head on over to jwillis.com.
Tasteful sculptures, that's right.
Jay, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Of course.